Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 24th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, The Leadership We Hunger For, Session 2, Leadership Grounded in Suffering and Wonder, presented by Dr. Sharon Delos Parks, Number Lens 2003-07. Let's listen in.
Thank you for your affirmation and your re-welcome. And thank you again for the quality of conversation that is emerging among us and for what each one in this room brings to who we are together. And a special gratitude to you, Chip, for who you are as a model of ministry among us in so many, many dimensions. It's a feast. And deep gratitude to Mark for the way he called us to prayer and to, I will always remember his talking about his son with the broken remote and the way to pray. And it reminded me of what Quakers often experience is that when there is really what Quakers call a covered meeting, when there's really a sense that the Spirit covers the meeting, that one may begin to feel that one is moved to speak in a certain way, and then someone across the meeting will rise and say exactly what you were going to say. And there's the sense that the word is given to the meeting as a whole, and only one or a few are those who are actually the ones who speak. And so as Mark was speaking this morning and was inviting us to think about how we pray, I was affected again by the way in which I hear in the colleagues with whom I'm speaking in presentational form that it seems that Spirit has been weaving Spirit's way through all of us with similar themes, similar issues, similar word. Yesterday, I was speaking about the call to adaptive leadership in contrast to the call to authority. And I heard Tony Robinson, who is the minister of Plymouth Congregational Church in Seattle, who has been taking Ronald Heifetz's work very seriously, say rather matter-of-factly recently that he believes that adaptive leadership, the practice of adaptive leadership, is necessarily spiritual work. Some speak in our time of integral leadership, meaning that to practice the kind of leadership that now seems to be called for requires the joining of a depth of inner spiritual ethical consciousness with the capacity for thoughtful, skillful action in the outer world. That the inner and the outer must be something of a seamless fabric. That we must not only look outward at what beckons us, but listen inward with greater scope and depth. Because of an intuition of a call that requires, it seems, the ongoing formation or reformation of the soul. When I speak about a new global commons, and decisions that we are going to have to make as a global human family, make in a collective way. When we speak with each other and begin to suggest that we are all responsible for people in California, 42,000 of them homeless in Chip's neighborhood. When we are made to reminded that we are responsible if we live in Washington for living in a state that has the most hungry of any state in the Union, I find that sophisticated, caring, educated people say, Sharon, it's too much. It's too big. I keep responding, however, with words to the effect, and here I feel a bit on tentative ground, that I believe that in the evolution of our species, that something qualitatively new is being asked of us, as persons and as leaders. Our cosmology and our social covenants are being profoundly reordered, and we are being asked to dwell in a bigger here and a longer now. We are being invited into a larger imagination, a further step into the imagination of God. Christopher Fry's Sleep of Prisoners captures the moment. He wrote, "The human heart can go the lengths of God. Dark and cold we may be, but this is no winter now. The frozen misery of centuries breaks, cracks, begins to move. The thunder is the thunder of the flows, the thaw, the flood, the upstart spring. Thank God our time is now. When wrong comes up to face us everywhere, never to leave us until we take the longest stride of soul we have ever taken. Affairs are now soul-sized. The enterprise is exploration into God. What are we waiting for? It takes so many thousand years to wake. But will we wake? The human heart can go the lengths of God. Events are now soul-sized. And increasingly, you and I are being invited to live in a soul-sized world. In the wake of September 11th, 2001, the place we have come to know as Ground Zero has become a holy pilgrimage site. As John Owen suggested last evening at the fireside conversation, it has also become a micro manifestation of the larger world to which we all belong, a micro expression of our new global commons. 7 months after 9/11, previously scheduled, I joined with several others to be present at the conference at Trinity Church Wall Street, which is just blocks from Ground Zero. While we had a theme already in place for that conference, we got on a conference phone call, and as presenters, we tweaked the title. And I don't remember exactly what it was before those events, but after those events, the title became, How Then Must We Live? Spiritual Formation in a Broken World. I allowed that question to address me in a new and fresh way. And when the time of the conference came, and a few of you were there, I found myself a bit chagrined because there I was talking on the very edge of my own emergent spiritual horizon. And I was a bit chagrined because my colleagues, one in particular, not missing a beat, presented his most practiced material that he has given over and over again. It was utterly fitting. And I said to myself, Sharon, you could have presented your most practiced material in this big event, which is downlinked to thousands all over the country, et cetera, et cetera. Now, 17 months later, I am still practicing in response to the question, how then must we live? And you are not going to receive practiced material. There are two primary responses to this question, we might say. One is to fortify ourselves in every possible way to protect ourselves, physically, emotionally, economically, and politically, at all costs, politically, economically, emotionally, physically, spiritually. This is an understandable response, and it spawns gated communities and tries to create a gated nation. An alternative response is to open our hearts and minds to the new realities upon us, including somewhat new questions. What constitutes safety? Who is we? How big is my world? Why do they hate us? What is now asked of us? Can we all dwell together and flourish in this small planet home we share? What do we mean now by the common good? If we wade into these questions, we in the United States have discovered that the towers of the World Trade Center belonged in more ways than we had imagined to our new planetary commons. Those who led the attacks believed that the activity in those towers influenced their lives a world away. Those who died in the towers included citizens from home places all over our planet, evoking a great outpouring of common grief and broad recognition that something of deep significance had occurred within the shared interdependent reality of the whole human family. We are now being invited to become responsive and responsible citizens in the life of this new shared reality that is complex, diverse, and vast. Increasingly, what we are now called to and called to respond to are issues of internet, whether they are international issues of international trade or global climate change, issues that seem at a remove from where we think of ourselves as placed and competent. I was attending a reception for a group of young environmental leaders, and Dennis Hayes, who founded Earth Day, was speaking. And he said to them, he said, it was easier for my generation. He said, we did the Clean Air Act, and he said, people could kind of get it, that they didn't want to be able to chew their air. But he said, you have to work at the issues that now the big ones that are most dangerous to us are at a remove. Issues like global climate change. Your work is harder. What is the process by which the soul is enlarged enough to embrace what seems at a remove? In our own study of the formation of people committed to the common good, when we were looking at that formation and trying to find the deep patterns, what we tell in Common Fire, and let me be so obnoxious as to say, not obnoxious, no, generous. Common Fire is a book you can use. It is wonderful to gather around as a hearth There are 7 chapters. They can be done in 7 weeks. And whether or not one talks about every point in the chapters, they evoke the kinds of conversations we need to have among ourselves, in our parishes, in our congregations. We have found that in the formation of commitment to the common good, there are 2 broad background findings. One is that in the formation of faith that is now needed, there must be a sense of enough trust in life, enough trust in one's experience of the world, that one can wade into all that complexity, diversity, and moral ambiguity. And the other is that there must be enough sense that I have some sense of power, or as it was spoken of early, power as empowerment, that I have some sense of agency, that I can affect my world. But the only finding, in addition to those 2, that held across all 100 lives that we studied and was a bit of a surprise, was that everyone who was able to sustain commitment to the common good rather than just to me and mine, someplace, somewhere, or many somewheres in their formative years, had had what we have come to call a constructive or transformative encounter with otherness. Otherness exists wherever there is a meeting across tribal boundaries. We all need tribe. We all need those networks of belonging in which we know we are at home, in which we are comfortable. We know what to wear. We know how to talk. We know how to be, and we are at home. But we all know that the virtue of tribe can become the sin of tribalism. And tribalism exists whenever we would tolerate for them what we would not tolerate for our own. Tribalism exists whenever we would tolerate for them what we would not tolerate for our own. And so we have found that the constructive encounter with otherness is when we encounter one or ones outside of our own tribe and we form a bond across those tribal boundaries. An empathic bond. Not just that we love their food or their humor or their art, which are all good harbingers, but we particularly form a bond with their suffering or their pain. We heard this kind of encounter when Paul Simon talked about his time in Somalia, and he told us about that boy with the infected eye who he will never forget. We heard about this when Chip talked about his encounter with a man going through the trash in the early morning. That encounter with otherness that awakens compassion, and it awakens respect, and us and them is transformed into we, which becomes the ground of commitment to the common good and is the alchemy by which, as Douglas Steere, the great Quaker philosopher, has said, God is always revising our boundaries outward. God is always revising our boundaries outward. For many, these kinds of encounters have taken the form of particular sets of images and stories from the events of 9/11 that have become alive in our imaginations. They are working in us, and under the auspices of Father Time, as Chip suggested, we are undergoing reformation. One of the images that has taken up residence in my soul comes from Joanne Martindale. She is an Army National Guard chaplain and director of the chaplaincy at a psychiatric hospital in Ancora, New Jersey. For 44 days immediately following the attacks, she served at Ground Zero in Staten Island, and she tells this story. Along with other chaplains, I provided pastoral care for the New York Police Department, firefighters, and other workers who were going through the debris from the terrorist attacks. One day, I saw a police officer welding open a car crushed at Ground Zero. When the officer opened the car, he found a man's body and the body of a child fastened in a car seat. He saw the stuffed animal and the small shoes next to the car seat. The man lost his ability to cope and in desperation threw the welding tool several feet in the air. He saw me walking by at that moment, and this tall, big-boned police officer said to me, "If you are very strong, can handle a grown man's anger, and can walk at least 3 miles around this godforsaken dump, then walk with me, chaplain." We walked, she says, for 2.5 miles around the dump before he said in a broken voice, which led to nonstop crying for 45 minutes, "I accidentally dropped my 4-month-old baby 7 months ago, and our baby died from broken neck injuries. When I saw that child in the car seat earlier, it reminded me of my only son who is now gone. Why is there so much pain in the world, chaplain? Why did this happen to me? Why does God want me sorting through the bodies and debris at this site? What do I do with my grief?" The New Commons is global in scope, personal in impact, and it asks big questions. In today's world, any one of us already has or is vulnerable to experiencing profound suffering similar to the policeman welder. And you and I are asking if our souls have been prepared, have been formed for that depth of personal suffering. At the same time, whether our own suffering is large or small, you and I want to be capable of walking in the shoes of the chaplain, able to go the distance and be a holy presence for others in a world of big questions. Why did this happen to me? Why is there so much pain in the world? What does this suggest for the formation of soul that is fitting to the ethical, faithful leadership that is now called for? Conversations with two different colleagues inform my response. Betsy Taylor is the executive director of the Center for a New American Dream, which is an organization in Washington, D.C., that works to help individuals and institutions reduce and shift our patterns of consumption in order to enhance our shared quality of life. Betsy is a woman of deep spirituality, a prophetic and faithful voice, and her website should be linked to all of our websites. She and I were talking on the phone coast to coast when she remarked that she had just come from a high-level meeting where a number of significant leaders in our society were present. As she shared with them her perceptions about what our patterns of consumerism are doing to us and to our world, she said their response was respectful and sober-minded, and they acknowledged that she was right. But they also revealed their preoccupation with other matters, leaving no time for what was recognized as of critical concern. Betsy said quietly, "Sharon, it really is up to us." And then she continued, "I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. But I do find it's important to stay in touch with the suffering." Later, reflecting on my conversation with Betsy and the fact that she stays in touch with the suffering, I recalled conversations with another colleague, Jerry Milhan, a turnaround manager, and he was then the executive director of Fossil Rim in Glen Rose, Texas, a place that stewards 2,000 acres of land and works to preserve endangered species, prairie chickens, rhinos, cheetahs, and many others. When Jerry coaches other managers across a wide range of organizations, he advises them to stay in touch with the wonder. When you stay alive to the wonder of what is happening in your organization, he says, you stay in touch with the essence of what you are trying to do. The practice of wonder keeps you alive and noticing. Did you notice how much Chip this morning was inviting us to wonder? As I have reflected further on the work of these dedicated and effective colleagues, what has become clear is that while Betsy is tracking the suffering, she is, I know, also a woman who is consistently alive to wonder, delight, and awe, whether it is in her relationship with her own child or in another context. On the other hand, while Jerry insists that we stay in touch with wonder, I have noticed that always, when he enters a new organization, one of the first questions he asks is, where is the pain located? Where is the suffering? Both Betsy and Jerry live and work in the paradox that to be human is to suffer, that we know we create suffering. And to be human is to dwell also in awe, reverence, and joy, alive to the fact that we are an integral part of a single, vast, and luminous tissue of life. We experience inexplicable grace. We are blessed with conscience and consciousness. We can ponder, who are we among these stars? Or as Joan Baez, that sage from another age, put it, she said, I do not know whether it would be worse to bring a child into this world and expose them to the disease we call society, or to rob a potential being of seeing one orange-red sunset. Consciousness and conscience are best schooled at the crossroads of suffering and wonder. Suffering and wonder poses the biggest questions. In my own contemplation, I am attempting for my own soul's sake to pay attention to encounters with suffering and wonder in the life of our new commons. I remain, for example, haunted by the account in the New York Times Magazine of February of 2002, a story titled Trapped. It is the story of 55 villages in the hills of northern Afghanistan. Here the Hazara people have lived for 1,000 years. Their supply routes were cut off by war, and several thousand of them began dying of starvation and disease after 9/11. Diseases known and diseases no one can name. They were thrilled when American planes began to fly over their villages. They had heard rumors that we were dropping food packets. But the planes flew on loaded with bombs to be dropped elsewhere, and the food planes never arrived. Meanwhile, as the winter snows approached, they remained cut off from their traditional supply routes. The healthy among them made a hard and difficult choice. And finally, 40 families, 200 people, decided they would flee and go to Iran. They were inadequately prepared. Many of them had either plastic shoes or open-toed sandals, and yet they had to walk 400 miles on foot through some of the roughest terrain in the world. It was very cold. They slept in a single mound with the ones on the inside rotating to the outside through the night, rotating so that in the morning they would all still be alive. It took them 20 days and 20 nights to reach the border, and they did, with everyone alive. But those who might have taken them across the border demanded money, and they had no money. Thus, they were forced to try to return, and then they began to die. A few did make it back to their villages, and sometime later, the International Rescue Committee looking for those who were suffering that others might have missed, did find them and stem the tide of starvation. But for several thousand people living in 55 villages that had never appeared on anyone's map, the rescue came too late. Receiving such accounts through print or electronic media can serve merely to inform me. It can serve the formation of my soul, my vocation, my life. I have a choice. This is something at a remove. I can read and deflect the new knowledge into a mental bin of interesting information. Or, in contrast, I can take it in and allow it to become alive in me. If I do so, I become connected with a people and a region and dimensions of consternation and courage different from my own. If I meditate on the implicit connections between their experience and mine, I become aware of my direct and indirect complicity in their suffering. The significance of allowing myself to be touched by their suffering is that it can burn through to compassion, create a conviction of possibility, where I find myself saying, there has to be a way, which gives rise to the courage to risk. My imagination opens into alternative possibilities in response to the question, how then must we live? I am moved to new frontiers of prayer and into new behavior. I find myself compelled to ask deeper and bigger questions about war, and especially about these new wars, and I am led to places I did not plan to go. As I keep in touch with suffering in these and other ways, I try to be alive to wonder and to what is wonderful. There is also wonder at a remove. During a recent Christmas season, our friends Bill Graves and Francie Wood went to Mexico and visited a region where the monarch butterflies roost during our winter. Led by a trained guide, they were part of a small group on horseback who slipped into an open pocket in the forest, where just ahead they beheld great tall trees, totally covered with monarch butterflies. The group, they say, fell silent. And everybody quietly wept. The mystery of the monarch butterfly's long migration has begun to arrest our attention. Monarch butterflies are becoming one of our teachers as we begin to learn both scientifically and spiritually the wonder of the intricate web of life upon which we depend, while discovering how much it depends on us. As we are the first generations to know that we affect the monarch's fate and the fate of most other species, we are also beginning to recognize that we do not have a theology of creation, a philosophy of science, an economic imagination, or a social ethic to greet that fact. Thus, we discover that in the encounter with the wonderful, as in the encounter with suffering, we are invited to see ourselves in right proportion, who we are, who we are not, and who we might yet become. We have the opportunity to get a better grip on what is precious and what is peripheral, what is our true desire, and what is enough. Suffering and wonder are often intimately related. Many saw on national television the account of the firehouse in New York City, where on September 11th in 2001, in contrast to the experience in so many of the other firehouses, every single fireman returned alive. We watched them one by one come into the firehouse, meet, fall silent, embrace each other, and weep in the wonder of being alive. Similarly, we can imagine that the women who lost their husbands in the events of 911 and who subsequently gave birth to a child they had conceived with a father now dead know intimately as they hold the new life in their arms what it is to live at the crossroads of suffering and wonder. Suffering and wonder in the most ultimate and intimate dimensions we can experience are, I suggest, the twin poles that can reliably orient our souls as we learn to navigate the life of the new commons. What is at stake is the formation of values and ethics, souls and societies. In the consciousness of authentic suffering and authentic wonder, we all become contemplatives. As Parker Palmer has written, contemplation is not the special skill of a disciplined few who have mastered some esoteric set of techniques. Contemplation is any way of penetrating illusion and touching reality. We arrive in this world with an inborn contemplative capacity, the soul, the inner teacher, the God, the spirit in every person, that helps us survive and thrive by keeping us grounded in reality, if we will let it. If we will let it. Indeed, a primary challenge to spiritual formation in our time is that grounding in reality that is critically needed is easily sidestepped. There are so many temptations to bypass the suffering of others and to escape the encounters that awaken us to wonder. So much in contemporary society has the effect of distracting us, distancing us, numbing us, and thereby cheating us out of the life-transforming encounters with both suffering and wonder that can enable the wise and shy soul to be formed in a larger citizenship, a deeper patriotism, and the greater faithfulness for which we have been created. In a world running on cybernetic time, we skim the surface of things, unable to pause, go deep, and let wonder and suffering take hold of us. In a media-rich world, we are systematically distracted from the suffering of others, and we are numbed to our own. In a world where increasingly news is spin or entertainment, and multiple pieces of information on a screen vie for our attention, we are insulated from the complex but clear-eyed truth that would call us to rigorous discernment between what hurts and what sustains the flourishing of life. In a society where escalating of levels of violence are pawned as entertainment, it is more and more difficult to be either astonished or reverent before the daily reality of authentic, piercing, devastating, avoidable suffering that riddles the fabric of the whole earth community. In an economy that places most of us in the anxious class, it is easy to lose touch with what is precious and to become confused about what we truly long for. In a society where the abuse of alcohol and drugs, both legal and illegal, has become normative among large segments of our population, including and especially our young, we fail to initiate our young into the natural high of genuine aliveness and wonder, and we blunt the edge of our own. In a culture in which the individual ego is placed at the center of our conventional notions of success, we miss the transcendence of a false self-importance that both suffering and wonder yield and require. In contrast, David James Duncan describes another way of being. He has just tried to absorb the consequences of the sanctions against Iraq in terms of the deaths of thousands of children because we destroyed the water systems and were subsequently unwilling to allow the importation of either plumbing or chlorine. He tells us that a trusted mentor once said to him, "If you don't know how to take something, take it on a physical level." And then Duncan writes, "The closest I can come to following this advice with regard to a rock's children is to rely on the physical senses, eyes, and heart of a woman named Jerry Haynes. Jerry is a woman who lives in Woodinville, Washington. She's a nurse who heads a group called Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. She has been on 3 missions of mercy to Iraq before the most immediate war, and 10 months before the most recent war in Iraq, she was wanting to return again." Duncan writes, "Before this recent trip, amid all the flag waving and war rumblings, Jerry's oldest daughter tried to persuade her mother to stay home. Jerry didn't describe their discussion, but she did say that finally, accepting Jerry's sense of mission, the daughter offered her mother an old-souled piece of advice. 'If you do go,' she said, 'be completely present wherever you go.'" These words returned to Jerry in an Iraqi hospital, virtually bereft of medicine and hope. While her group moved from bed to bed, Jerry approached a woman sitting next to her dying child. Jerry speaks no Arabic. The woman spoke no English. Trying to be present anyway, Jerry looked at the child, then at the woman, and placed her right hand over her own heart. The Iraqi mother immediately placed her right hand over her own heart. Jerry's eyes and the mother's eyes simultaneously filled with tears. The hospital was crowded. Jerry's visitation time was short. She started to move to the next bed, but then remembered her daughter's words, "completely present." She and the mother were already crying, their hands over their hearts. There was nothing more that Jerry could do, despite all her medical training, for the child. How much more present, she wondered, is it possible to be? She stepped forward anyway, with no plan but vague allegiance to the commandment. Completely present, the nurse without medicine stepped toward the bed of the dying child and the inconsolable mother. She then put both of her hands out, palms up. The Iraqi mother fell into her arms. "If only this experience were unique," Jerry told me. "But I can't tell you any longer how many mothers I've held in this same way." Her voice grew faint over the phone. I heard, "Diseases that children would almost never die from in the U.S. I heard, "Medicine so basic." Then her voice faded, or maybe I drowned it out. I've never taken notes while sobbing before. David James Duncan is willing to be a contemplative, to allow his soul to be stretched, to move beyond where it now dwells, and to be reformed in order that he can be a faithful citizen in the life of the new commons. I belong to an initiative which has become an organization called the Contemplative Mind in Society. It was formed by 2 presidents of 2 different philanthropic foundations. These presidents shared the conviction that we are in some peril because in a society gone busy, we do not have contemplative time. The pause time essential to imagination, essential to the ethical life, essential to the practice of leadership. I have served on a committee that gives fellowships to professors in colleges and universities across discipline who are willing to work to restore contemplation in the intellectual life by creating a course that will include learning about or actually practicing contemplative practices. This is in an attempt to initiate future leaders into the power and practice of contemplation. One of those fellowships went to a woman who is African American and who teaches poetry at West Point. She has told us that she is the only professor there who is both civilian and black. The only professor, she says, with dreadlocks. She comes as the daughter of an army family. And she says that I have been plagued by self-doubt, never sure I'm teaching well enough, never sure the students are learning what I'm trying to teach them. And that self-doubt has this semester been exacerbated by the clash of our very different cultures. Sometimes I feel like an Aborigine lecturer at Oxford. These ramrod kids in their gray uniforms, their shiny shoes, their yes ma'ams and no ma'ams. I'm teaching these people to meditate. Sometimes it feels absurd, yet when I've asked them whether they would like to abbreviate our communal meditation or dispense with it altogether, the cadets have unanimously elected to maintain those 5 minutes of silence at the beginning of class. Ma'am, those are the best minutes of my day, they say. I look forward to those 5 minutes, ma'am. Several have suggested we meditate more than 5 minutes. They turn off the lights, loosen their ties. Some of them take off their shoes and sit cross-legged on the floor. I set the timer. We close our eyes. We enter silence. I'm having them practice several different techniques during the semester. We've done 2 weeks of breath awareness meditation, 2 weeks of mantra meditation, 2 weeks of meditating on small pebbles, two of meditating on the gift of forgiveness, a walking meditation to do during spring leave, 2 weeks of awareness meditation, two of koan meditation, a final week of simple silence. In the last week of the semester, we lay out a labyrinth, inviting the entire corps of cadets into its meditative space. Sitting there in the dark room, surrounded by intelligent, strong, healthy, dedicated young people in uniform, I sometimes cheat. I open my eyes. I look around. They sit with closed eyes, so young, so full of future. The method I'm trying to teach requires time and quiet, and these are in short supply at West Point. My cadets often ask me how they compare to normal university students. She teaches in two places. They ask whether I have modified my normal teaching to accommodate them. I haven't been sure how to answer their question. I could say that knowing how little discretionary time they are allowed in a day, which begins at 5:30 and ends with taps at 11:30, I am more careful making their assignments than I am when making assignments to my normal students, who much of their time is their own. I know that I am less likely to be annoyed and certainly less likely to express my annoyance when they inform me they will miss classes. Receiving email messages in which I am addressed as ma'am and being respectfully informed that a cadet has guard duty or must be away for a trip section evokes a different emotional response from noticing that a student is missing from class or has come to class unprepared or is completing work for another class as I lecture. And given the nature of human history, given unforeseen natural disasters, given our failure to learn from our mistakes, these young people are liable to be in a situation of turmoil or armed conflict someday. I don't tell them that I teach them both more gently and more urgently than I do my other students. You and I know that all of those with whom we minister, given the nature of human history, given unforeseen and natural disasters, given our failure to learn from our mistakes, are liable to be in a situation of turmoil or armed conflict someday. and it moves us to teach and preach more gently and more urgently. We live in a society in which daily we are being formed with an individual and collective call. And it is a call to become consumers. And it is going against the tide to hear the call to become contemplatives. As Joan Chittister, our wonderful Benedictine sister, has written, contemplation is the search for the sacred in the tumult of time. It is not something for its own sake. To be a contemplative is not to spend life in a spiritual jacuzzi, some kind of sacred spa designed to save humanity from the down and dirty parts of life. It is not an entree into spiritual escapism. Contemplation is immersion in the driving force of the universe, the effect of which is to fill us with the same force, the same care, the same mind, the same heart, the same will as that from which we draw. A spiritual path that does not lead to a living commitment to the bringing of the will of God is no path at all. It is a pious morass, a dead end on the way to God. Clearly, contemplation consigns us to a dangerous state of openness. Contemplation is not ecstasy unlimited. It is enlightenment unbounded by parochialisms, chauvinisms, genderisms, and class. The breath of God, which the contemplative sets out to breathe, is the breath of the spirit of compassion. The true contemplative weeps with those who weep and cries out for those who have no voice. The real contemplative takes the whole world in and shelters it, reveres it, and protects it with a body made of the steely substance of a justice that springs from love. To be a contemplative, it is necessary to reach out every day to the outcast other, just as does the God we breathe. This set of reflections suggests that, as theologian Margaret Miles has shown, we are all being invited in this hinge time, in the reality of our vast new commons, to reclaim the ancient prayer at the heart of Christian asceticism, God, make us truly alive. If spiritual formation is grounded in practices, ways of life, things that people do with and for each other to make and keep life human, we are being invited to practice in new or profound ways contemplation, to be fully present to our own suffering, and especially to suffering of those we regard as other. At the same time, we are being invited to practice contemplation in ways that make us fully present to wonder, to opening ourselves to what Dorothy Day called the duty to delight, placing ourselves in the presence of awe and joy. In so doing, we will be compelled to engage the question, how do we together transform the patterns of life that distract and numb and oppress? The human heart can go the lengths of God. Events are now soul-sized. Spiritual formation for citizenship and ethical leadership in the life of the new commons invites us to a stretch of soul that can embrace the suffering and wonder of our shared life across oceans and continents, across the desk and the neighborhood, in the confidence that it is that stretch of soul for which we were created and for which we pray. I borrow from the words of the poet Rilke. Take your well-disciplined strengths, stretch them between the two great poles, the opposing poles of suffering and wonder, because it is inside human beings that God learns. Thank you.
Bravo.
Now I want to ask a question for your contemplation. We have a little bit of time before lunch. I want to invite you to the question, what did you hear yourself saying while I was talking? What did you hear yourself saying while I was talking? Now you've begun to get a grip on that. Would you turn to one person nearby and share what comes up, what has come up for you? What have you been sharing that you would be willing to comment on for all of us? Yes. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Nice, thank you. One step that will make another step possible. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
It reinforces to me that.
Speak up.
I just had a brain fart.
Oh, okay. Oh, dear. Well, be sure you speak up when it comes back. Okay. Let me say just a word in relationship to staying in touch with the wonder. I must confess that in my own life, I have discovered the need for a discipline to stay in touch with the wonder side. And my stepson, a couple of years ago, gave me a lovely calendar from a museum, and I use a day runner, you know, and so forth. And I couldn't use it as a date book as such, and I wanted to use this gift from him, and so I decided I would put it on my nightstand, and that every night at the end of the day that I would just make a notation of some moment in the day that had been a moment of wonder or delight. And I must confess that on one hand, it has been a grace in my life in that I do then look back and notice. But there are days that I come to that ritual and that practice, and it's not that I've had such a painful day that it would sort of violate it to put down something on the other side, But it's just been, I've been chugging through the to-do list, and I have been numb to what have been, might have been moments of delight or wonder, or at least I've not been able to have them impress themselves on me enough that I can remember them. And I offer that because I think as people of conscience and people in this room, that our hearts are prepared to remember and to become more alert to the suffering. But there's work to be done on the other side as well in terms of what is genuinely wonderful and of delight for us. And again, I appreciated Chip this morning and the way he invited us to notice we had wakened to a new day. This might be the most beautiful day we would ever experience, and so forth and so on. Other comments? She remembered.
It reinforced for me that every life has a story. And in those stories, you hear the pain. You hear the suffering. And if we would only just listen to the stories.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Remember the Sabbath. Keep it holy.
Thank you. One more. Thank you for that. Ronald Heifetz suggests that a great deal of the practice of leadership is the courage to look beneath to the hidden issues and to be able to surface them and name them. And I think some of us experienced that quite powerfully last night when Chip and others were raising the question of reparations, which has been a conversation that is beneath the surface for many of us but is rising, and we are going to be asked to engage with that. And apart from our recovering the practices of Sabbath, as was lifted up, apart from our recovering those spaces where we create a spaciousness where spirit can work, we aren't going to be able to be reformed. And Lutherans do have a heritage of reformation that is, we all share it across Protestant traditions, and Roman Catholics have their own version of it, and every religious tradition does. But if the power is in part in the story, there is a story to be known and renown and so forth, and it came through the life of a monk. And recovering the life of the contemplative is probably essential and something that you as a particular tribe within the company of faithful people on the planet at this time may have a special gift for being able to realize in our world. It's time for lunch, which is another kind of pause and contemplation. And let us celebrate it. Thank you.